can relay for the morning session. I guess you could say that I'm Nori's replacement, but don't think that I could fill his shoes by any means. Those are some really big shoes to fill. And today I'm going to change gears a little bit. I'm going to talk about gravitational cell force in short space-time. I thought it'd be nice to remind ourselves why we're doing this, because we really want to find gravitational waves. And for the types of objects that we're interested in, we're going to look at LISA data stream. And in that data stream, we want to see signal from what we call extreme mass ratio in spirals. The problem is the signal is not very strong, so it's going to be buried under what we call confusion noise and instrument noise. And to get the signal out of the noise, we need very accurate templates so that we can do good match filtering. And to get very accurate templates, we need very precise cell force computations. Now, the reason why we're doing this in the frequency domain is we want to be able to cover the parameter space. And we want something that works fast. So we think that what we're doing with frequency domain will give us a pretty good handle on fairly eccentric orbits and give us a way to start covering the parameter space in a reasonable manner. Now, the cell force problem in Schwarzschild background has actually been solved. State of the art is Barak and Sago. The eccentric orbit paper is, I think, archived 2008. There has been work done in the frequency domain. With the Kerr background, you know, you just listen to Niels's talk. Very nice results for eccentric orbits. Of course, we're doing scalar field. Hopefully, there's lots of brave people tackling the gravitational cell force problem in your background. OK, background. We have a small particle of mass mu moving in Schwarzschild background. It induces a perturbation in the space-time. So instead of having a test mass following test mass geodesics in Schwarzschild background, we're going to follow geodesics of the actual space-time, which is the background metric g mu nu plus some perturbation term added to it. So now we solve the perturbed Einstein equation in a non-flat background with a non-vacuum source, which is our particle. And so what you do is you put this into Einstein's equation, and you return only terms linear in H in the perturbed part. And just remind yourselves that background is actually vacuum, so you can kill that part of the equation. You get something that I will show you in a minute. But before I show you that, you make a few more simplifications. We change our field variable. We go to trace reverse metric, like you would do when you look at gravitational waves in a flat background. Then we make a gate choice where we pick the Lorentz gauge, so your field is divergence-free. That's assuming that we also have a source that satisfies normal things like the continuity equation and energy conditions. And with those simplifications, the Einstein equations become 10-second order coupled wave-like equations. I'm calling them wave-like because they don't exactly look like wave equations. The source is a delta function source. And what we also have here is some coupling between our metric fields given in the Riemann tensor. Now, this equation, if you can solve it, gives you the fields of your perturbed metric. What we want to look at is the cell force. And the cell force itself is constructed from the gradient of these metric fields, where you take a certain projection that makes the cell force orthogonal to the four velocity of the particle. Now, the equation on the previous slide, this is in space-time variable, so it's function of t, r, theta, and phi. You want to simplify it. You can use nice things like separation of variables. Here we're dealing with tensor equations, so we use tensor spherical harmonics, where you can take any rank 2 symmetric tensor and you can have a 10-dimensional basis for it. This is assuming that we're in 4 dimensions. In Kerr, you use spheroidal harmonics, and Niels showed kind of what they look like. Here we're going to stick with tensor spherical harmonics because we're doing Schwarzschild background. So our metric fields can be rewritten in our new basis in this form, where the h bar i's are the new fields we're interested in solving. They're only functions of t and r. And our spherical, tensor spherical harmonics are given by these YLMs with space-time indices on them. These are some normalization factors. The nice thing about using this is, of course, that your angular variable theta and phi decouple. The Einstein equations become, at each L and M mode, a simpler looking equation that is only a function of T and R, where the box is your usual scalar field wave operator, given here. And the F is our usual Schwarzschild radial scaling function. And since we've changed to a new basis that we denote by the letter I, which is 10 dimensions, so it runs from 1 to 10, we call our our modified source, which is thought proportional to a delta function, we simply call these SI. Now we want to go to frequency domain. And the reason why we want to do that, again, is because we think it's going to work faster. And we hope that it's going to work faster for eccentric orbits up to a significant eccentricity, hopefully. Now, we don't really know what that eccentricity is, where it's actually more efficient to switch to a time domain code. But we hope that once I get this thing working properly, we'll determine what that value is. But for circular orbits and small eccentricities, we expect frequency domain to work faster. So for now, I've only done circular orbits. So let's fix our radial location to R0. And then we Fourier decompose in frequency modes in time. So my fields HI are now simply new fields R that are only functions of R times our usual exponent. And our mode frequencies are given by M, which is our orbital number, azimuthal quantum number, times the big phi, which is your orbital frequency. With that substituted into the field equation, you now have a one-dimensional second order ODE. You actually have 10 of these. And unfortunately, but as expected, they couple together. The coupling is given in these M terms. And it looks quite daunting at first, I guess. If you're doing post-Newtonian, then it looks like nothing. But to me, it looks kind of scary. This is one example of what these coupling terms look like. On the being a horrible scale, I would give this an 8, somewhere less bad, somewhere worse looking. On top of the 10-second coupled field equations, we get 4 gauge equations, because we have a gauge condition. And that gives us 4 more first-order coupled ODEs. The nice thing is, though, not all of our 10 equations couple together. Because we're using tensor spherical harmonics, which have decouple under parity, we have what we call an even sector, an odd sector. And what happens is that the 10 ODEs actually split into 7 even parity ODEs and 3 odd parity ODEs. And similarly, the gauge equation split into 3 even and 1 odd. The even modes are given by L plus M equals even integers. And so when you're trying to solve for the fields in the even sector, you only have 7 equations to deal with, 1 through 7. And your other fields in the odd sector are naturally 0. And similarly, I guess, in a complementary way, if you're in the odd sector, so L plus M equals odd, you only have to deal with 3 fields, 8, 9, and 10. And the other 7 right here are all zeros. There's actually a further simplification. And what happens is that, for example, when you have to deal with 7 ODEs, you don't have to solve all of them together at once. In fact, basically, we say that not everything couples together at each given mode. So that gives you a way of solving things hierarchically. So you solve a certain set of ODEs first, you get the solutions, then you take those solutions, say, use one of the gauge equations, and get another field out. So this is sort of a table that shows you how you do it. For example, for the monopole, L equals 0, M equals 0, you actually only have 4 equations. 4 fields. In fact, it's simpler than that. It turns out that the monopole solution is analytic, and it only depends on the trace of the metric. And the trace is only given by these 3 variables, H1, H3, and H6. I should call them R's now. This actually is even 0. But a generic case, for example, in the even parity modes, you would have 5 coupled ODEs to solve. And then once you get the solutions for those 5 equations, you would go to the next ordered in the hierarchical scheme and solve for the other fields, for example, 2 and 4. This is what I call an ODE solving tree, sort of illustrates the whole procedure. Some, as I've mentioned, are analytic, some solutions. Monopole is analytic. L equals 1, M equals 0 are analytic. And so are all the L equals odd, M equals 0 modes. The rest of the modes have to be solved numerically. But you don't always have 5 ODEs, coupled ODEs to solve for. For example, for L equals 1, M equals 1, only 4 coupled together because 7th is trivially 0. So you solve 4 coupled ODEs, then you get 2 more from the gauge condition, et cetera. As you can see, there's lots of different numerical cases to cover. Now, we're doing frequency domain solutions, and the crux of the problem is coming up with boundary conditions. In time domain, you don't have to deal with this problem. In fact, Sam said this himself. He said you don't even do boundary conditions. You have to worry about not even initial conditions so much. Sam said it himself. You start with some arbitrary initial conditions. But what happens is that you wait long enough to actually evaluate your fields, and all those inaccurate initial conditions go off as spurious radiation. They leave your grid, so you don't have to deal with this problem. In frequency domain, we have one-dimensional ODEs that we're solving for, so we need to specify very accurate boundary conditions to solve them. To do that, we simply look at, I guess, the physics of what's going on. If you're looking at dynamic modes where M is not zero, then you should expect to find ingoing waves at the horizon and outgoing waves at infinity. So we set up an ansatz where our wave part, ingoing and outgoing waves, are given by our usual exponents. And then we have some infinite series that actually is in this form. And what happens is you start with some initial value, k, that we call k start, which should be free, that we pick arbitrarily. We usually pick 1, for example. And then, because we're actually solving things numerically, you have infinite series. We truncate the series at some k max that we determine numerically, where we look at the next order in the series, and if it's smaller than 10 to the minus 14, we truncate the series. For the static modes, we determine the boundary conditions by regularity. For example, what will happen is, if you're looking at an outer solution, you'll have linear combination of two solutions like r to the l and r to the minus l plus 1. And since we want the solution to be regular, as in disappear as you go to infinity, you pick the one that's r to the minus l plus 1. Now what we do is we take our ansatz, substitute it into the field equations, and that'll give you a recursion relation in these unknown series coefficients ak and bk. I don't want to bear you with equations, but here's an example of what these recursion relations look like. This is for the inner field R3, and the recursion relation looks like this, where these things, the g's and the h's, are actually functions of l, m, k, omega. Omega here is m times omega phi. So what happens is you have to do this for every time you're solving the ODEs numerically. As I've shown you in the ODE tree, if you count how many times you have to do that, it turns out you have to do this 28 times. So I have to derive 28 relations like this. I did it for you by hand, but because I did it wrong so many times, that took like a week each. But then I got clever, and I started using things like computers. The K-max is the value at which we truncate our series, and we find out that often it's between 5 and 10. It's never more than 10. Okay, and we tested the convergence of the series by simply adding an extra term and seeing if the residual left over when you plug it into the ODE is smaller than the previous one. We've checked that every time it is. Of course, I should mention that so far we were actually solving it for the homogeneous solutions. To get the inhomogeneous solutions, you have to do matching at the where the particle is with two junction conditions. The fields need to be continuous, and the first derivative in the field should exhibit the standard jump discontinuity. And so what you do is you match the fields. In fact, it's very much like undergraduate quantum mechanics, where you try to match fields across the delta function potential. Of course, we have many coupled fields. We follow a prescription by Detweiler and Poisson, 2003. I'm going to skip over this. But basically, what happens is these parameters, the Ka start that are free, that start our recursion relations, determine for us a vector space where, depending on how many free parameters we have a certain n-dimensional vector space. For example, if you look at an even sector case, we have 7 field equations, 3 gauge equations, so we should have 4 degrees of freedom given by these parameters that start the series. So what happens is you solve the homogeneous field equations for every basis element in your vector field. So we have 4-dimensional vector field, so we get 4 different solutions out for inner and outer homogeneous solutions, similarly for the derivatives. Then what happens is you want the inhomogeneous solutions, so you invert an 8x8 complex matrix, where the right-hand side is got the continuity condition for the first 4, that's for the field, and the bottom 4 are for the jumps and the derivative. You invert this, you get the complex amplitudes x1, x8, and so your inhomogeneous solutions are given by these combinations. Some numerical details. I'm coding in C, use GNU Scientific Library. I find that this integrator is the fastest in all cases on solving the ODEs numerically. I usually stick with the typical absolute and relative error of 10 to the minus 10. Now, as I mentioned, the ODE is solved many times at each mode. First of all, the complex and real and imaginary parts decouple, so you do that twice. You have to do inner and outer homogeneous solutions. So at each LM, you solve 4 times for those. And then you have an n-dimensional vector space, so that adds to it. So it's 4 times n. For example, even sector generic case, you solve the coupled ODEs 16 times at each LM. Odd sector, 8 times. If you're doing a run from 0 to 15, it turns out that you have to solve the system of ODEs more than 1,500 times. And this is the monster that takes up all our runtime. Some speed tests. So these are some results. Different orbital radii. These are runtimes really quickly. The thing to note is that I can do 15 modes. This is gravitational cell force in less than 10 minutes in all cases. And if I want to do 30 modes, the runtimes are on the order of an hour or so. This is a plot of log time versus log of modes. The wavy ones are where I have to change where my outer boundary is, so it affects the runtime. But I've done a few where I actually didn't change the outer boundary location. For example, for this, because I put it far away. And it has almost a power law behavior that kind of goes like this. That just kind of tells you that if you double the number of modes, your runtime goes up by a factor of 7. OK, output, and this is what we're interested in. My code has field outputs. And I can compare these with what Leo and Nori had done in 2007 for their circular orbit code. These are their plots, and these are my field outputs for one even mode, L equals to M equals to M, one odd mode. The match visually is pretty good. Here's one case where the sevens, the fives, and the halves match pretty close. But I don't have numerical data from Leo or Nori yet, so I don't know if they actually match perfectly. How do you get the cell force? Mode sum scheme. You sum over L modes of regularized part of the cell force. And what this is basically it removes the divergent part in your infinite series. It removes the part linear in L and removes the 1 over L term. So your series is actually L to the minus 2, which converges. We don't have to regularize in T because we're doing circular orbits for now, so we only regularize in R. And physically, this corresponds to basically just keeping the time-like support for the Green's function. Final complication comes from the fact that the mode sum scheme and the regularization is not in spherical harmonics, but we're in tensor spherical harmonics. So we have to change all our output to be in form of spherical harmonics. So this means that there's a coupling between each tensor mode L and up to 7 scalar modes. So for example, if I'm looking at L equals 2, I have to actually compute from 5 to minus 1. But we don't have L minus 1, so we set those equal to 0. So this gives you a final complicated expression where these things contain the field, the derivatives of the fields, but in certain coupling fashion. If you want to know what these look like, look at Lior and Noyes' paper. And so I actually have all these coded in. And the last thing you do is, because this sum is infinite, we truncate at some large L. And we extrapolate to the tail, the remaining terms, by this kind of 1 over L squared power law fitting, not power law, polynomial. And so currently, I actually have a code that computes the self force. I can go up to nearly 30 modes. I only stopped there because one boundary condition was giving me trouble. I had to manually type in the formula. I only went to 31. So that's where I stopped. Runtime, about 1 hour if you want to do this so many modes for small orbits. It's not there yet. I have a, I wouldn't call this a minor problem. It's a big problem right now. The regularized components are supposed to be continuous, but right now they're not matching. And the other thing is, some of my fluxes match with the published results, and some don't. So I got to figure out why this is happening. I won't know till I can compare field outputs between my code and Norrie's code. Once I know I can fix these things, I'll do the large L tail, no big deal. That's just kind of showing me how fast things have been taking. Ultimate goal, eccentric orbits in Schwarzschild. Hopefully, we can go up to large eccentricities. The code is going to slow down a lot, depending on eccentricity. But I'm still maybe somewhat optimistic about it, because if I can do 15 modes on the order of 10 minutes right now, I feel that with my desktop, I can probably cover 10 to 20 points per day in the parameter space, even for something like reasonable eccentricity. That's all I have for now. Thank you very much.